This is a continuing episode about the film The Xenophobes. The series started at episode 342.
Mommy's an angel of peace. She will stop the fighting.
You've got a husband and two kids. And Cottrell is...
I'm Lancer Kind. I co-wrote a science fiction film called The Xenophobes. It's about a crew of astronauts who traveled 60 years to make first contact with an alien civilization. And things, didn't go the way anyone expected. Not for the characters, and honestly, not for the people who made the film either. We shot this film during a pandemic. Our lead actor flew from Moscow to Manhattan, Kansas, through borders that were closing behind her. Our director was also our cinematographer and our editor, and the story we ended up telling feels even more relevant now than when we wrote it. These are some of the folks who brought this film to life. They were the actors, the director, support staff, and the technical staff. Let's hear from Hal Dace, the director, the editor, the special effects, the props creator, the guy who pretty much held everything together.
So Hal, I hear you're the director of Xenophobes. How did that happen?
I'm also the executive producer, so I conferred with my conscience for days and days, and then I finally hired myself as director.
Excellent. Well chosen.
Thank you.
I wonder what if there was a resume that was passed along too between those two.
I've seen my resume many times, and I'm very impressed by it.
Yeah. Right. So, Hal, why did you do Xenophobes?
I have to be honest and admit that I set out to write something that would not be too difficult to film on a low budget in Kansas.
That's true.
And I think I succeeded in writing something that could be done in that way. Although during pre-production, I suddenly changed my mind and decided to set a chunk of it in Colorado. And that went well. It was hard work, very hard work for everyone involved. But doing the alien planet scenes in Colorado was a very good idea in the end. It worked out real well.
Yeah. Nice. I want to capture that moment where you were telling me how you've been planning a lot of your life, I guess, to do a film like this.
Well, yeah, there were lots of influences. I've always wanted to do something kind of similar to Star Trek, but to fix all the things that they do wrong. And then I was also inspired by Stanislaw Lem. He wrote Fiasco and Back from the Stars. I mean, the famous one, obviously, is Solaris, which has been done twice, most recently by George Clooney. And that picture, I thought, turned out quite well. But Lem doesn't... I mean, for some reason, Solaris translates well to the screen. Tarkovsky's version is brilliant. But none of his other novels work very well for Hollywood. And that's probably just as well because Lem hated Hollywood. I didn't want to try and do an adaptation. And I wouldn't be able to afford to pay his family the option anyway. So, I worked very hard to be inspired by those novels, but to come up with my own story. So Fiasco is obviously the first half of the movie, and Back from the Stars is obviously the second half of the movie. Anyone who's familiar with those novels will instantly make the connection. And another influence was A Clockwork Orange. I wanted to emulate the idea that comes from A Clockwork Orange that if you're artificially controlled through a substance to eliminate violence from your personality as an individual, then you have to question whether you're still a human, because a critical element of humanity is being removed from your personality. And in my opinion, you effectively become a different species when that happens.
got this project together and you start shooting it. What are some of the challenges in getting that done?
Well, there's been two huge challenges. The first one is the pandemic, which caused the film to be delayed 3 times, both directly and indirectly. There was the more direct problem that we couldn't get everything ready in time for the original schedule because of the lockdown that occurred in March 2020 and April of 2020. But then indirectly, it also caused major disruption to the United States Customs and Immigration Services. And because of that indirect but very large disruption, the star that we chose to play the lead role, Svetlana Tulasi, was not able to get her visa as quickly as would be considered to be normal. It took much longer than we expected. But we decided that Svetlana is such a terrific actor and so perfect for the role that we decided to go ahead and keep delaying production until she was finally able to get her visa and come to the United States. That I count, believe it or not, those two things I count as one big hurdle, because it's all either directly or indirectly owing to the pandemic. The other huge hurdle was money. I had a misunderstanding with one of my investors, and which continued for a long time, and we thought we were getting more money than what it turned out we actually did get. And if I had known in advance that we were not going to get the full amount that was originally promised, I would not have put the film into pre-production. I wouldn't have started hiring people. I wouldn't have started doing all the planning. I wouldn't have started doing all the 3D printing. But luckily, we were able to raise the rest of the money that we needed. It took a very long time and a lot of hard work by a lot of people to raise the rest of the money that we needed, but we finally managed to get there.
Cool. All right. And so we're speaking to each other in the movie studio, which is in, I can't pronounce the county fairgrounds. Could you help me with that?
We're filming here at the Pottawatomie County Fairgrounds in Pottawatomie County, Kansas. There's another Pottawatomie County in Oklahoma, I believe. Maybe even one in Iowa. I'm not sure. But anyway, I knew all along I wanted to shoot the Earth part of the story in the town of Onega, so I approached the town council in early February 2020 and asked them permission to do a lot of filming in the streets of their town, and they said sure. And not only that, I also wanted to shoot the barrack scenes in the Onega Elementary School. So while I was at the town council, I said, so when's the next school board meeting? And they said, oh, it's next week, so you ought to go to that too. So I went to that too. And I was talking to the school board, and they voted unanimously to let us film in their schools. So that was terrific. And then towards the end of the meeting, I said, by the way, do you know if there are any empty warehouses around here? Because I had a hunch that I would need a cheap place, and Onega's 50 miles from Manhattan. So I thought that an empty warehouse would be a bit cheaper here than one that's closer to Manhattan, Kansas. And they said, well, you don't need a warehouse. We've got a fairgrounds building you can use. So a few days later, the head of the Fairgrounds board showed me the building, and it was perfect. I mean, this building is really almost custom made for a filmmaker to turn it into a studio. It's worked out really well.
Nice. Yeah, some good fortune. So Kansas has really supported this endeavor pretty well then.
Yes.
And I see a lot of the talents, local talent, and you know, you brought in some stars, of course, too. Let's talk story for a while. So it's inspired by some Stanislaw Lem novels, and it's being executed here in Kansas. How is it going? Like, what do you think your biggest challenge was in this?
Well, story-wise, there's another thing that inspired me that I'd like to mention, and that is that science fiction movies never mention time dilation, except for Interstellar. And they really blew it. I mean, they got the science right, but they got completely confused that Christopher Nolan really should have told a story about space travel, not an astronaut who unfortunately gets a little bit too close to a black hole. I mean, I understand that time dilation happens when you do that, but nobody cares about that. What people do care about is the problem of traveling to another star. That's what's important. Not accidentally getting too close to a black hole. And by the way, they also turned the black hole into a wormhole. So I kind of like Christopher Nolan, but yeah, Interstellar was a truly awful film, and it's mostly bad because of Christopher Nolan's bad story. But anyway, if you're going to tell a science fiction story, come on, get with the game. Tell a story about going to an alien planet. Star Trek does it all the time. Why can't other science fiction storytellers in the cinema tell the story about going to other stars where there are aliens? Except why can't we tell the story in a more realistic way? Because Star Trek is really just pure fantasy. There's almost nothing in Star Trek that will ever actually happen in real life, except for their communicators. And we've already got those now. So we don't need to fantasize about those. And so one of the first things you have to learn about space travel is that you cannot travel faster than the speed of light. You just can't. Einstein figured that out over 100 years ago in 1905. If he figured it out, how come science fiction writers can't figure it out? And furthermore, in my humble opinion, I know I don't sound like a very humble person, but
well, it's your interview, Alan. You can handle it however you want.
In my opinion, when you actually follow real science, it actually makes it easier to tell real drama. I mean, we're getting serious pathos out of this story. And when you keep falling back on crutches like hyperspace, it actually gets harder to tell a story with real pathos in it. It makes everything too easy. I remember in J.J. Abrams' first Star Trek movie, they traveled from Earth to Vulcan in 10 seconds. What was that about? I mean, give me a break. You can't travel to another planet in 10 seconds, even if you can do hyperspace. That's just, what were they thinking? No, it takes years to travel to another star, and we're going to have to get used to that. We're going to have to get used to the idea that if you're assigned by the government, if you're a spaceship captain and you get given a mission to go to an alien planet and go visit some aliens, it's going to take like at least 6 years to get there, at least. And if you get assigned to do that, are you really going to leave your family behind? Round trip, 12 years without your family? They're never going to make astronauts do that. They're going to let the astronauts take their families with them, because that's the only way they're ever going to be able to convince really smart people to go. I mean, of course they could send single people to go, but what if you're the best dang captain in the fleet and the president of the United States wants to send the best captain to another planet? What if that really, really great captain just happens to be married and has children? No, they're going to let you take your children with you. And so we need to, that story needed to be told, and it's never been told before, so that's one of the things I was trying to do is to try and use real science to get some pathos out of a story.
Nice, yes.
Okay, so the time dilation doesn't just, it's not at all about how long it takes on board the ship to get to an alien planet and come back again. The time dilation is what happens on Earth. And so if you go in 30 light years to another star, on Earth, it really does take 30 years for the ship to get there and 30 years to come back. Mm. But on board the ship, because of time dilation, it seems like only 6 years are occurring in each direction. And so you're gone for 12 years, you come home to Earth, you're back from the stars, as Stanislaw Lem would say, and what's happened? 60 years have passed on Earth. Unless people have really long lifespans, which is possible because it takes place a couple hundred years in the future, almost everyone you know will have already passed away by the time you get home. But in my story, the people's lifespans are quite long, so we get a genuine twin paradox moment where a man who's about 60 is talking to his brother who's 120. And because of longer lifespans, he looks a lot older.
I think it was his younger brother who's now older. Wasn't that the story situation?
Well, yeah, but only... I don't recall if I made that clear, actually.
I don't remember either.
I just assumed... You just assume that they're probably not too far apart from each other in their number of years, and yet one is clearly much older than the other one.
Right.
So that's a fun moment, because ever since I saw Carl Sagan do Cosmos way back in the late 70s, where he explains the twin paradox visually in a very brilliant way, and it's one of the reasons why it was one of the most successful documentary TV series ever. Ever since I saw that, I've always wanted to do a really good time dilation story, and I can't understand why it's never been done in a movie before. So I hope that people enjoy that about this film.
Do you have anything else you want to say before we close?
I would just like to say that when the original series of Star Trek was made in the 1960s, they had a pretty low budget, and their sets were kind of cruddy. They were made of wood. When they walked around in the bridge set in Desilu Studios back in the day, the floor would creak. And so the sound editors had to work really hard to remove all the floor creaks in between the dialogue. And the actors had to be really careful to say their dialogue when they weren't walking, so there wouldn't be any creaking noise. So, it, you know, they didn't have it easy with their cheapo special effects and their cheapo sets. And we don't have much money either. And if you can tell when you're watching our movie that it is low budget, I hope you'll make a little bit of extra effort, just like you would if you watched the original series of Star Trek, to suspend your disbelief so that you can enjoy the story and not get too distracted by our low budget. But we are working really hard to do really good quality special effects, and hopefully it won't be too obvious that it was a really low budget film, although most people will figure it out, I'm sure, while they're watching it.
The Xenophobes is available right now on Amazon Prime Video. You can rent it for around $4 if you watch it and enjoy it. The single best thing you can do for us is to leave a star rating and a review on Amazon. And for goodness sakes, tell your friends to watch it too. For an indie film like ours, every review helps new people find us. You can find behind-the-scenes photos and updates on our Facebook page at facebook.com/apistrophepictures. There is a link in the show notes. What are show notes? Show notes show up right in your podcast player for your easy access. If you're using a podcast player, they're right there in the interface. If you downloaded the show from a website as an MP3, go back to the website where you got the MP3 and you will see the show notes there. And if you want more about the making of the film or some cool banners, type into your favorite search engine, lancerkind.com/xenophobes/banners. There, the magic of the search engine will bring you right to my doorstep, and you will be able to click and download whatever banner you need for whatever social media situation you've got. Sport your colors and show off to people about this film. So that will help spread the word, and we will love that. You should download your Xenophobes banner today. Next episode, we talk to Kristen Tompkins about wardrobe and continuity.
But I've never really thought about like a drug or whatever that would stop like violence, and that would be interesting, but there's also, as you can see, there's some side effects to that. And so I hope that doesn't really happen to the world. I hope that just, I don't really know how to explain that.